there is one controller and it's trying to talk to a lot of these subsystems. It's trying to monitor all of them. So in that case, we need like a proper data protocol, right? So who initiates communication? Who talks? How does the computer know who to speak to? Which subsystem to talk to?
ZukunftsmacherInnen, der Alumni-Podcast der TU Berlin. Rashana Reddy Mamedi, unser Gast in dieser Folge unseres Alumni-Podcasts aus dem Herzen der Hauptstadt vom Campus der Technischen Universität Berlin. Schön, dass ihr dabei seid. In dieser Podcast-Reihe geht es um die Zukunft, genauer um die, die sie machen, um die Alumni der TU Berlin. In jeder Folge stellen wir euch einen oder eine von ihnen vor. 35.000 Mitglieder hat das Alumni-Netzwerk aus 139 Ländern. Menschen mit den unterschiedlichsten Talenten, Ideen und kulturellen Backgrounds, die sich bis heute mit der TU Berlin verbunden fühlen. Sie alle eint der Wille, die Welt ein Stück besser machen zu wollen. Aber wie? Wie überträgt man das, was man an der Universität lernt, in das spätere Berufsleben? Wie findet man seinen Weg? Wie kriegt man heraus, wie und wo man das, was man aus seiner Universitätszeit mitgenommen hat, anwenden kann? Was sind das für Wege, die man da einschlagen kann? Schnurgerade Autobahn oder kurvige Landstraßen? Genau das möchte ich aus meinen Gästen herauskitzeln. Ich bin Regine Marxen, Journalistin, Podcasterin und Host dieser Reihe. Mein Ziel ist es, von unseren Gästen zu erfahren, was genau sie in ihrem Beruf motiviert und wie sie dort hingekommen sind, wo sie heute stehen. Wir sprechen über Visionen, über Learnings, über Scheitern und über Erfolgsmomente. Darüber, was genau sie heute beruflich treiben, um das Morgen zu gestalten. In dieser Folge spreche ich mit Rashana Reddy Mamedi. Rashana kommt aus Indien, hat dort am Indian Institute of Space Science and Technology ihren Bachelor of Technology in Avionics und 2019 an der TU Berlin den Masterstudiengang Master of Space Engineering abgeschlossen. Derzeit arbeitet sie als Entwicklungsingenieurin bei Berlin Space Technologies. Sie entwickelt Broad Data Handling Systems für Mikrosatellitenplattformen. I want to learn as much as I can about space, sagt sie in diesem Podcast. Und wenn sie über ihren Job spricht, möchte man sofort auch in diesen Bereich einsteigen. Getroffen habe ich sie digital. Das Gespräch fand auf Englisch statt. Als erstes habe ich sie gefragt, Rashana, dein Job ist es, das Chaos im All zu verhindern. Was genau heißt das eigentlich?
I work on command and data handling. So essentially I write software for the satellite. And how that works is essentially we have one main onboard computer on any satellite, which controls all the other subsystems. Like, you know, we have like from the very visible solar panels and batteries to other subsystems that rotate the satellite in different directions we want. There's the camera or there's a transmitter that talks to the ground. So all these subsystems are being controlled by the central onboard computer. And this data protocol, so, you know, there is one controller and it's trying to talk to a lot of these subsystems. It's trying to monitor all of them. So in that case, we need like a proper data protocol, right? So who initiates communication? Who talks? How does the computer know who to speak to? Which subsystem to talk to? Mm-hmm. And once you say, hey, I want to talk to you. And then the subsystem says, okay, you know, send some kind of an acknowledgement. And then the computer thinks, okay, this person is responding. The subsystem is responding to me. Now let me give my command. Or sometimes if you can put all the subsystems in some sort of a monitoring mode and then you can say, hey, only contact me if there's something really wrong or something is really heating up or something is, you know, not working as expected. So all these sorts of so we need like proper protocols to enable this sort of a smooth communication between all the subsystems within the satellite. And that's the role of an onboard a data handling system. Mm-hmm. And there's a software team usually that works on it. And when we usually say software, it's more of an embedded systems kind of approach, right? So because when we often think of software engineers on the ground working on other applications, they are usually agnostic to the hardware. But satellite software engineers working on satellite hardware or any piece of hardware, essentially, so they are more concerned about the hardware. So every time you're writing a piece of code, we are thinking, oh, is this small enough to fit on my on my tiny computer? So you're always thinking from that perspective.
How many people are in your team?
The whole company, we are about 50 people working on different aspects of the satellite design. And in the software team, it's the biggest team. We have almost 15 of us working on it at various levels.
Is it an international team?
Yes, it's quite international. There are a lot of Germans. There are a lot of Berliners, actually, in our team. But it's quite international. The company itself is, yeah. In general, I would say space in general is quite international. And that's one of the advantage of working in the space sector in different geographies, because the customers of any space company are so international. Most of them, the operating language, the official language is English. So which makes it quite easier for people from, you know, different geographies, different cultures to come and work together.
What exactly are the challenges of this job?
Like I said, the biggest one is resource constraints. So be it either you're a software engineer or, you know, developing the electronics or building boats or trying to design the complete structure of the satellite, the engineer is always constrained for resources. You cannot add more and more, as much mass as we want. No, we can't make the structure. Hey, let's just make the structure that will hold everything. We can't do that. You have to really optimize everything, each and every gram, each and every square centimeter, because several things. First of all, there's like a design constraint. And secondly, the launch cost. The cost of putting every kilogram up there really counts. Though the cost per kilogram is drastically coming down because of a lot of companies like SpaceX and then also a lot of other companies, still there is constraints in terms of power as well, right? Because if the satellite is so big, there's only so many solar panels we can put on it, even if we deploy them, you know, not just put it on the surface, but even if we deploy, there's only so much power that the satellite can generate. So one of the biggest limiters is not only mass, but the power we can generate on the satellite. And that severely limits what kind of payloads we have. That limits, you know, at what height we can have the transmission power, how powerfully it can transmit a signal back to the Earth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of these ramifications.
Your educational CV looks like a straight line. What is so fascinating about space science?
Yeah, so my space journey actually began way earlier. In high school, in school, I wanted to become a psychiatrist, actually, you know, go into the life sciences. And I was really interested in biology. Hmm. But then I had this opportunity to participate in one of these student competitions organized by NASA, the American Space Agency, and it's still running. These programs are still running, and NASA has, you know, been the pioneer of a lot of space research for many, many decades. So they organized a competition called Space Settlement Design Competition. So essentially, they bring a lot of these cool kids together, high school kids, and give them a task saying, hey, build a space settlement on Mars for like 1,000 people. And then there's going to be like 100 people visiting you, and you have to figure out everything for that settlement, from where you're going to build it, how you're going to build it, how long you're going to build it, what materials are you going to use, and how to run the settlement, you know, how to do the operations if something breaks down, what happens, how to allocate the resources, how much food are you going to grow, what minerals or metals or materials are you going to mine from nearby objects, and if there is a tourist population of, I don't know, like 100 people, how are you going to entertain them? How do you create, a nice tourism? So how are you going to entertain them? And how do you how do you generate money? What's your sources of money? How sustainable are you? So all these things, of course, it's a futuristic scenario. Yeah. It's set in usually 50 years or 80 years from now. Yeah, the concept is quite old, but then for a high school student who's never been really out, and then we compete with teams from across the world. So often you're paired with a team from like the other side of the planet, and it's a new culture, and you come together, and then we all brainstorm and imagining itself creating a colony on Mars or a settlement on Mars was fascinating for us. And that's, I guess, when the space bug really got me. And yeah, I'm still high on that, riding high on that till now. And that enabled me to take up a bachelor. So this bachelor, the university I went to for my bachelor, the university was started by the Space Agency of India, actually ISRO, the Indian Space Research Organization. Mm-hmm. So they wanted an exclusive, a dedicated university for them. So they have a continuous supply of talent of engineers. And our courses were mostly generic courses at undergrad level, but we had a lot of specialized space technology subjects to, courses to take up. And we had a lot of, one of the biggest, largest centers of ISRO was right around the corner of the university. It was in the southernmost tip of India, of the country. And it was so fascinating because sometimes we would have these scientists come and teach us courses, take all these lectures, and then they explain about rocket engines, say, hey, this is how it works. And that part is something that I have built 20 years ago or 10 years ago, or this is what I'm researching on right now. So that was so fascinating for us to have the actual rocket scientists come and explain, all these fascinating concepts. And then we would go visit the launches, the sounding rocket launches or the big rocket launches. So it was a very, it was more like another space center, everybody's talking about space, all the competitions we had in the university were all space themed, we're all like really star-struck people. We would have a nice, a bunch of telescopes. So we would go out in the night and then we had somebody who was specializing in astronomy and we would look at all these Saturn rings, how to assemble this telescope, how to, point it correctly, how to handle this telescope. And how to looking at Saturn rings or the moon. It was fascinating. And one amazing thing about this university is after we graduate, we get an opportunity to choose to work in one of the ISRO centers, and which are distributed all across the country. And yeah, so from then on, it was quite a natural progression. Once I took this undergrad, once I finished my undergrad, I started working in one of the ISRO centers. And my job essentially was to work on the ground data processing. So the satellite generates a lot of images, let's say, and then it sends it down to the Earth. And then someone has to process these images. So that's the ground processing chain, is what it's called. And my job was essentially to write algorithms so that is happening as fast as possible.
Now you are a member of the group Women in Aerospace, and there is a Berlin chapter too. And how big is this group and who is in it?
Yeah, so Women in Aerospace is actually an international networking group for women. It was started many, many years ago. In Europe, it was started by Simonetta Di Pippo. She is currently the head of the UNUSA. UNUSA is this United Nations Office for Outer Space Activities. And the Women in Aerospace Europe has several local groups. Again, there's one local group in Berlin, which we have started. And there's so many. There's many in Germany as well. There's one in Darmstadt. There's one very active in Bremen, Toulouse, Paris, everywhere. There's a lot of local groups across. I was quite surprised that there wasn't any local group in Berlin. It's so diverse and it's so international. And I was a little surprised it wasn't really there. And that's how me and another couple of my colleagues, like Vera, she was previously with Airbus, and Juliana Haupt, she's also from another space company, Astrofine in Berlin. So all of us got together and we thought, hey, let's start this. It's quite new. We started 1 year before the pandemic, so we couldn't pull off a lot of the events that we had planned. So essentially what the networking group does is they organize a lot of activities. It's very often in-person activities or sometimes online seminars, which are directed at, sometimes we have a project management seminar. So they rope in somebody who is an expert in project management or in life skills, and then have kind of seminar and focus a lot on issues that most often women face in the professional world or in STEM careers. Actually, a lot of people in tech, the more competitive the environment around them is, the more they suffer from a lot of issues of self-doubt and not being sure if they're good enough. The more the more highly skilled the people around us are, and the more we progress in career, most people actually apparently experience this, especially in tech. And I feel most often women suffer from a lot of these things because somehow the society molds them across cultures, right? Across cultures, you know, women are often more self-critical, and they hold themselves to a much higher standard than usually than men. Of course, there are outliers, there are exceptions, but this is a very general trend. And also, if you look at any of these job descriptions that post, they say it's statistically shown that women only apply to a job advertisement if they match 100% of the requirements listed there, while men apply only if even if 40% of the requirements match to their skill set.
So let's look at your career again. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to study in Berlin?
Yeah, so this was back in 2017 when I was making the decision. So I wanted to, like I said, I was working on the ground segment data processing of things, and I wanted to work on the spacecraft segment, you know, go a little bit into space. And I also wanted to try out different geographies because space is done so differently everywhere. You know, how space is done in India is very different from how it's done in Europe versus how it's done in Australia or the US or South Africa or South America. So it's quite different. So however, I really liked the kind of courses I was looking for was I wanted to do a master because that's a great way to enter any new space ecosystem as a student. It's much easier. And I wanted a master level course that would focus on the satellite design aspects. So back in 2017, most of the master level courses related to aerospace or space would focus on the launch vehicle part, you know, the rocket part. Like, of it, there were very few courses that focused on satellite building. And I only found two courses. One was in the US, which focused on space systems design. But US was not a choice for me because they have these ITAR regulations where only citizens can work in their space companies or space agency. So, of course, that was a bummer. And Europe that way is quite amazing because there are almost no restrictions unless it's a very, I guess, a strategic or a defense-related project. There are absolutely no restrictions on the nationality of the person. And the second course that I found was in Berlin. It was the Master of Space Engineering at TU Berlin. And alongside TU Berlin has a very long history of building a lot of amazing satellites for many, many decades. And so, yeah, it was quite an easy choice for me to make.
Do you remember your first day at TU Berlin? What was it like?
I still remember walking along the corridors. It's in this aerospace building of the TU Berlin, they have a lot of mock-ups. They're also actively building a lot of satellites all the time. And you have large pictures framed on along the corridors of all the satellites that have been launched. And I was just walking along, and then I realized, it just hit me, you know, like, wow, there's this 50 years of building satellites in a university environment, like right here. So that's something that I still remember.
High expectations. Were there moments when you thought you couldn't succeed in your studies?
Yes, not in my studies as such. This was more of a systems level course. And since I already came from a space background, I knew a lot of the basics. So I was not very skeptical of the entire course as such, but there was one course, there was one particular course called Spacecraft Dynamics and Control. So this course essentially helps you to figure out how to orient the satellite, right? So one of the biggest aspects in operating a satellite is, let's say there's a camera on the satellite, and the camera should always be pointing, let's say, at some specific part on the Earth. So you want to image it, and it wants to point it, you know, we don't want it to like move too much or vibrate too much. We want a decent level of stability when it's pointing. And so to do this, there's a lot of sensors, a lot of actuators that come into play. So first of all, we need to know which direction the satellite is pointed. So you take a reference of the sun, and then you take a reference of the Earth's horizon. Then we take reference of the stars and try to, you know, figure out, okay, this is how my satellite is currently pointed at. And I want to move it, you know, orient it in this direction. So essentially rotate. And this is three-dimensional rotation, right? So like three-axis rotation. So that makes it a very complex mathematics problem. And there's a lot of mathematical, you know, modeling that goes underneath it. And yeah, so math is not one of my super favorite subjects. And I had a lot of difficulty following this. And however, it's not highly essential for the career path that I have chosen, but I had great difficulty. So yeah, I took up actually an advanced course on that subject. And yeah, I dropped it after like a couple of months. After a month, I guess I realized, no, this is definitely not for me. But I loved the freedom this way. So to try and sample courses and have, you know, It's not like once we opt for the course, you're not locked in. So I love the freedom that there is to drop courses which we are not really comfortable with.
Okay, let's talk about podcasting. You've got your own podcast. It's called Those Space People. What do people learn when they listen to your podcast?
Yeah. So this podcast was also one of the many pandemic babies. So that's what propelled me to make it. The podcast is all these very casual conversations between people working in space. So those space people. Because when usually people who are trying to enter the space sector, or somebody who's just looking at the space sector out of curiosity, a lot of the conversations or a lot of the visibility is mostly of either astronauts or, you know, heads of companies, of big companies, or heads of space agencies, which is really fascinating. It's absolutely amazing to listen to them. But very often the narrative is set. Right. So the narrative is set, and it's very difficult to get a complete picture of everything that's happening in space. So I try to have people who are at different levels, at different points in their careers, and working on different aspects of satellites or rockets or ground processing or different parts of the value chain, and have a very casual conversation with them. So this is the what gave me this idea was, every time one goes to these space conferences or events or anywhere, very often we have these very short, casual coffee side conversations, you know, like fireside chats or like a coffee conversation with people. And it usually goes with, hey, so I'm so-and-so and you are so-and-so, and what do you work on? And then we talk about, and then I usually ask questions. Oh, I heard that this is the latest thing happening in this aspect. What do you think about this? How do you think this is going to go? And very, you know, quick, casual conversation. And then it ends with, how can I stay in touch with you? And I wanted to bring the exact same format to the podcast, because even though there were a lot of virtual events happening during the pandemic times to compensate for this, it's never the same as speaking face to face. It's never the same as having that, you know, the camaraderie. And I realized it's much easier to reach out to people online. It doesn't make sense when I just say hi, you know. You just say hi on LinkedIn and that's about it. Hello, I like your work and that's about it. So there's nothing really to talk about. Then I realized when there's a podcast, you know, that you're recording it, that enables me to have this very nice conversation, casual conversation, sometimes very in-depth, sometimes only for 15 minutes. Some podcasts I had it for more than 60 minutes. So it's very, very organic.
Talking about the future, what's your personal aim in your business? What's your purpose?
My dream, I mean, I don't really have like a very concrete set dream, like I want to go to space, or of course I would love to go to space, you know, walk around on Mars and try to imagine the settlement we had built 15 years ago on paper. I would love to, you know, travel to space, experience weightlessness, yes, of course, all that. So I guess my underlying motivation for working in space is, yes, trying to understand, to make sense of what space is, how it can be used to solve a lot of problems on Earth, how it can make the world a better place. But if we zoom in a little more, I think at the core of everything is from my time as a high school student participating in the space settlement design competitions to, you know, now as an engineer, building applications, writing software for space missions. I believe it's, I think I get a lot of kicks out of building things in a resource-constrained environment. So I guess that's what I really find it challenging. So it, I love optimizations, and I also love, you know, tinkering and building stuff. So I guess it appeals to both of these interests of mine.
What would be your advice for our listeners? What do they need to become a space engineer?
A lot of people think that they need to study a very space specific, you know, a very fancy master degree or a very fancy bachelor degree that has space in it to get into the space sector. But that's one of the biggest misconceptions. So a lot of my colleagues, for example, even in my software team, it's hardly two of us of the 15 of us which have a master degree in something related to space. All the others come from a traditional computer science background. And similarly with you know, even electronics, the electronics team, the guys who are actually building all these computers or all the boards and all the electronics, a lot of them also come from very traditional, like, you know, electronics backgrounds. So I would recommend if someone wants to get into space engineering, I would highly recommend them to specialize in any area of engineering that they really like, and then try to find careers in space. There's always openings, and there's people are always looking out for talent. And now there's a trend of looking for people who are experienced in other sectors. So for example, some companies, the head of their software is somebody who has a background in robotics, you know, who spent 15 years building robots. And that's also a similarly resource constrained environment, right? So for example, we have, you have to pack all the power into a small tiny robot, and on top of it there's you know, you're trying to move the robot, and it's autonomous, and it's kind of similar to the space industry. So they try to look for people from different varied backgrounds whose skills can be scaled or translated to the space sector, so that way anyone can pursue a career in as a space engineer. That said, there are so many other non-technical aspects of space as such, and there should be, what I strongly believe, is there should be more and more people from other sectors. They should come and work in the space sector, because a lot of times space sector is dominated by engineers, and engineers have like a very, you know, like a set vision. They don't really consider the other aspects of space, you know, like the sustainability aspects or the environmental impact or the business aspects or the socioeconomic impact of, you know, the decisions we take as engineers. So I believe there should be a lot of people from other sectors, from other backgrounds, from different geographies. There should be diversity in space, not only based on gender, but on, you know, geography, from background, from ideologies, from ethics, from morals, in all ways. So we can take it further ahead and make the world a nice place for everyone. And one last thing, if anyone wants to get a better picture of the space industry, then they're most welcome to check out the podcast, Those Space People.
Okay, last question. What do you think will change over the next 2 or 3 decades? What are the challenges?
Wow, yeah. So the biggest challenge right now for space is the space debris problem. There's too many satellites, too many defunct satellites, too many parts, too many broken satellites, too many rocket stages. You know, the last stage of the rocket, which places the satellite in space. Even this last stage of the rocket is often left in space, and it's, you know, orbiting as space junk. So it's quite huge. But there are a lot of companies who are trying to. Even Europe, you know, ESA is actively trying. A lot of space agencies are trying to mitigate this problem. They're trying to clean up the debris, or they're trying to come up with better practices. So people launching new satellites from now on do it more responsibly. So it's very interesting to see which direction this would take, because from a regulatory standpoint, in the last few decades, and, you know, since the beginning of the space age in the 50s to maybe 10 years ago, all the treaties and all the agreements that were made for operating or staying in space, for ensuring sustainability, were between nation states, because it was mostly space agencies that were doing a lot of these space activities. But now there's a lot of companies, private companies that are doing it, and private individuals who are, you know, putting stuff up or going to space. And now it's interesting to see who would really spearhead all these efforts. And it is to be seen because, for example, if you look at the aviation sector, right, we have all these crazy number of planes flying around, but there's no collisions. Everything is perfectly streamlined. And these planes and the pilots speak different languages, all different countries, different cultures, different airspaces, different technologies. Everything still comes together and it's perfectly regulated. So hopefully someday soon there is proper, perfect regulation in space, because collisions are very common. They occur on an everyday basis almost. So for example, to give you a sense of how bad it is, the International Space Station, which orbits the Earth, it has to dodge, essentially, it has to change its orbit, move up and down every week to avoid getting hit by space debris. So that's just quite insane. So that is one aspect that's quite interesting to see how it pan out technologically, because there are companies which are trying different methods, right? There's one company that's trying to have like a fishing net sort of thing, to just throw a net and catch some space debris, or somebody who's trying to have some magnets. And there's also a lot of efforts to reduce, reuse, and recycle concept, you know, to repair satellites which are already there, so we can use them for a longer time instead of sending a replacement satellite. So there's that happening. There's more monitoring. There's more clearing up of space debris. And on the other hand, there's a lot of companies which are trying to build these mega, mega constellations, imaging constellations, or, you know, like the Starlink. So the communication constellations. And so it's to be seen how this entire regulatory aspect of space pans out. And and of course, there's a lot of efforts towards establishing space stations. Now the ISS, you know, not just the International Space Station, but the Chinese, they've already set up theirs, and there's more private space stations that are coming up. So we don't know how the tourism angle of it is going to be. We now have a lot of people regularly going to space, right? Doing these few-minute suborbital trips to space, experiencing weightlessness for a few minutes. So it should be seen. I don't know, maybe there's going to be a hotel in space where people would visit, or play microgravity games. I don't know, playing soccer or football in space, or Quidditch, or all these fancy Harry Potter kind of magical things. And also how we are. So the Artemis Accords, for instance. So how we are going to. So for example, if a lot of space companies or countries and actually end up setting up bases on Moon or let's say Mars or in orbit somewhere, how are we going to, are we just going to claim the land? What happens to the resources? How do we do it sustainably? What do we do to prevent countries from just taking their trash up and dumping it on the Moon? Because, you know, disposing of trash is a huge problem already on Earth. We are running out of ocean beds to fill it up and dump it in. So yeah, it's to be seen what decisions humanity would take for itself.
Rashana Reddy Mamidi. Ich kann euch ihren Podcast nur wärmstens empfehlen. Ein Blick in die zweite Reihe, also hinter die Kulissen der Raumfahrt, ist wirklich ziemlich spannend. Wir hoffen, euch hat unser Ausflug ins All gefallen. Wenn ja, freuen wir uns, wenn ihr diesen Podcast abonniert, ihn euren Freunden empfehlt und über eure Kanäle teilt. Folgt und kontaktiert uns gerne auf und über unsere sozialen Kanäle. Ihr findet uns auf Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn oder Xing. Mehr über die TU Berlin oder das Alumni-Programm erfahrt ihr auf den Seiten www.tu.berlin oder www.alumni.tu-berlin.de. Zum Schluss möchten wir uns bei der Senatsverwaltung für Wirtschaft, Energie und Betriebe in Berlin für ihre Unterstützung bei der Umsetzung dieses Podcasts bedanken. Und natürlich bei euch fürs Zuhören. Für heute sage ich Tschüss, bleibt gesund und wir hören uns. Yeah.
Yeah.